Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And today my co-host and colleague, Sam, can't join us, so I'll be going solo. And what a topic we have to discuss today. Recently, Hillary Clinton re-entered the public square to offer some reflections about what happened in the campaign, her thoughts about everything from the vote in states like Wisconsin to the role of former CIA Director James Comey with the late breaking news about the investigation that took place. And all of this brought back memories for many people, short, recent memories, and discussions about what unfolded in the 2016 campaign. And obviously, the campaign has not gone away, given the investigations that are currently underway into the connections between the Trump campaign and Russian intervention. So how did Hillary Clinton, who was once considered the most formidable and experienced person, certainly in the Democratic Party, but even in American politics, go down to defeat against someone who had so little political experience and who seemed to constantly alienate politicians and voters and the media? In the end, the campaign left the country with someone who seemed far outside the boundaries of conventional politics and left the campaign with someone who seemed deeply entrenched in all the fundamentals of electoral politics on the losing side. So this is a campaign subject that will keep giving. It will keep being the subject of intense conversation for decades to come. So we are delighted today to have two of the best people to talk about what happened in the campaign. Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes are the authors of a new book called Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign, which is out with Crown, and it is a bestseller and has recently been optioned also to be a television show. It has generated a lot of discussion, and since the moment it came out, it has been a basis for thinking exactly what happened to the Democrats, what happened to Hillary Clinton, and how we ended up this way. Jonathan has covered national politics for many outlets, Politico, Bloomberg, and Vox. He's currently the head of community and content for Sidewire, and he writes a column for Roll Call. And Amy is the senior White House correspondent for The Hill. She also worked for Politico before that, and I've spoken to both of them many times over the years. A few years ago, the two of them teamed up and published HRC, which looked at Hillary Clinton's time as Secretary of State. So welcome to the show. And I remember I was saying before we started that you spoke at Princeton a couple of years ago after your last book came out, and you had mentioned that you were about to embark on this project and to cover the campaign. And I admit, when you said, I was wondering, will there be enough scintillating material in such a scripted and in some ways what seemed to be a predictable campaign? Would it be able to generate interest? And boy, was I wrong. You guys have really sparked an important conversation. So congrats on all your success to both of you. Let me start by asking you, why do you think there's so much thirst among readers to read and think about the losing side of a campaign?
I think the losing side is almost more interesting than the winning side, especially in this case, because everyone expected Hillary Clinton to win, and they expected her to win big. And John and I did, too, I should say. Everyone on election night, we both thought that she would pull out a victory, that it would be close, but she would win. She was, after all, the one who had the traditional infrastructure. She had the surrogates behind her. She had President Obama, her husband, Michelle Obama. So no one expected this. And I think one of the things we sought to do in this book was answer that question, well, how did she lose? And it's interesting because we went into it asking, what did she learn from the original campaign? What lessons would be applied from that campaign to this one? And that's why we thought it would be an interesting read. But then all of these, you know, our reporting led us to a lot of problems and turmoil inside the campaign. And that's the book, the essence of the book.
And some of that turmoil is symptomatic, not necessarily causal. That mm-hmm. is to say, people have focused a lot in talking about the book, for those who have read it, on some of the internal strife within the campaign, some of the clashes among the leaders in the campaign. And some of that causes problems, but some of it is symptomatic of Hillary Clinton not setting up a clear leadership structure on her campaign, of not having a simple, easy-to-digest message and therefore a mission for everyone to sort of get behind and follow. I mean, the same problem that I think a lot of voters had in trying to get behind her. Her staff had some issues with that, too, trying to figure out what exactly is it that we're selling here? Mm-hmm. And, you know, why Hillary Clinton? Why now? It's one of the sort of big questions of the campaign. But I also think people are interested at some level because of the timing. I mean, you know, we got lucky in that I think this is coming out at a time where both people, you know, there are people who are supporters of Donald Trump who would like to have an explanation of what happened and would like to see the page kind of turned on the election. And I think that there are supporters of Hillary Clinton who were grieving for a long time and are now sort of ready to go through that sort of postmortem and that autopsy. And some people who are Democrats who voted for Hillary Clinton who are angry that the Democrats lost and want to make sure that they don't do the same thing again. So I think there's, you know, regardless of how you come at this, I think there are two sort of basic values. One is there's an analysis of what happened. But number two, there's just the reporting of, you know, the sort of moment by moment of mm-hmm. how she lost this campaign.
And then so before we get into the book, how did you end up doing this? So you wrote a book on Secretary Clinton. You finished the book. It did well, got good reviews. And then how did you move into the decision to work on the campaign itself?
Well, we had asked so many questions in the last book that this book seemed obvious, like an obvious thing for us to do. And I think that was basically the impetus of us writing this book, I think. And so we started reporting this in late 2014. And so this was before the campaign actually started. And then once the campaign started, we started actually interviewing people and finding out what was happening behind the scenes, and we started noticing problems like the message, problems that, you know, internal dynamics of people not getting along. And I think
this is already in like 2015.
Yeah, 2015.
As you're starting.
You know, one of the things she learned, Secretary Clinton, last time is that she wanted to kind of open up her circle and bring in Obama people. Mm-hmm. And so you have the Obama people coming in, you have Secretary Clinton's longtime staff that is also being brought in, and you also have people from the vast Clinton network and outside advisors. And so we wanted to know how all these people were working together. And sometimes they worked well together, and sometimes the operation was pretty seamless, and sometimes it wasn't. And that was pretty evident from the start.
And how does it work? Do you get access to the campaign, or you just say, I'm going to follow, you know, you're just going to do it informally?
I think we expected to get more sort of formal cooperation than we got, because we had done the first book and had gotten some pretty significant cooperation. This time it was more ad hoc. I mean, sometimes they would, you know, we would ask for people, like, provide these people, put us in touch with these folks, and they would do it. And most of the time they didn't, or often they didn't. And so we would just put out the feelers ourselves and talk to the people we wanted to, which we would do anyway. I mean, the first book was the same. There were people that we didn't ask for that we talked to, and people that they didn't give us that we talked to. And, you know, I mean, it's sort of catch as catch can.
And when you were starting, though, it still seemed, even though you noticed these problems, I mean, what was your feeling of how this campaign was going to go?
It seemed like it would go okay, but then you'll recall the email controversy bubbles mm-hmm. up, and that happens about a month before she actually launches her campaign. So we knew that there would be problems going in. And of course, she spends the next 6 months kind of on defense and is kind of annoyed internally that her message isn't being cut through all this. And one of the anecdotes in this book kind of details that she's sitting there and is frustrated about that, and her husband is frustrated, and there's one conference call in particular where they're both going off on staff to get it right. Mm-hmm. And I think so that was interesting, and that kind of played out obviously in the first few months.
Did they know when the email it first broke in the Times? Is it breaking the New York Times?
It was sort of a joint, like AP broke part of it and the Times broke part of it, but the big story that everyone remembers is the Times,
right? And yeah. What was their response? I mean, what was their internal response? Is this going to be a big problem, or were they, this is more media?
I mean, I think they underestimated it. I mean, that, you know, their first response was a little bit slow. They tried to figure out, I mean, first of all, they didn't have a campaign yet, right? Yeah. So you hadn't actually launched, but they did have people working on the campaign that had not yet launched. And there was a big discussion about, you know, how she should respond to it and what venue and whether it should be with one reporter or, you know, a press conference, that kind of stuff. And all of that suggested that there was kind of a cluster, that they didn't have any quick decision making on that.
And she even jokes that one of her aides joked, should we actually add a joke into a speech that she was going to give?
So they didn't really regard this as, like, you know, potentially existential threat to the campaign. They were talking about trying to use humor to get rid of it. And even after she gave her press conference to the United Nations, that people may remember, where she said she didn't traffic in classified information at all, and that obviously that turned out to not be true. After that, she sent a note to John Podesta, her campaign chairman, thanking him for helping her get through the first choppy waters of the campaign. They thought they had put it behind them at that point.
And then so as that's starting to unfold, you have a great section on the challenge of writing the opening announcement of this campaign and kind of the opening speech of what this will be about. Can you tell us kind of what happened?
So they want to launch, to do this launch speech. She calls in outside advisors. She has consultants and her speechwriter working on it. She brings in Jon Favreau, President Obama's speechwriter, and all of them are working on this speech together, and they can't. Favreau at one point is so frustrated that, because he's used to just working with President Obama, and he kind of gives up on it halfway through because there are too many cooks in the kitchen and they can't. Someone told us that it was your standard Democratic stump speech, but didn't really speak to her and why she should be running. So right off the start, she becomes the inevitable candidate again, and that was a problem that dogged her throughout the 2008 primary. And I think that this whole process, the speechwriting process, was pretty typical of what to expect going forward, and typical of Clinton world and her world specifically.
Was that? Sorry,
I was just gonna say, you know, I mean, one of our sources was talking about how they would have had a reason for running, or they wouldn't have run, and that just, it's like put such a sharp point on the difficulty of that speech, and you could use that observation all the way through the end of the campaign.
Yeah.
Where there really just was never that clean, clear, concise argument.
And is that her, or so that's what I was wondering, is this the campaign operation and the different voices, or was there something about her that the speechwriters couldn't quite?
It was her. She just had not come up with a reason for why her, why now. She had run 8 years earlier. What was different about Hillary Clinton, or different about the country, that meant it called for Hillary Clinton? And I think she had trouble getting over that.
Why? Why did she have trouble?
I think she never really identified the thing that was unique about her that fed what the country wanted. I think that was the difficulty for her.
There's also this rise of populism happening. She doesn't quite understand what's happening around her, but there was this longing for an outsider. And she sees the excitement behind Bernie Sanders' campaign, and she sees what's happening with Donald Trump. But we have one anecdote in the book where we talk about how, I think it's a really profound anecdote because it's post New Hampshire, after she's just been killed in that primary, and she's flying with a longtime confidant, and she's basically telling the confidant, "I don't understand what's happening in the country. She can't figure it out," and it's taken her that long to actually get there and have that moment, but she's kind of airing her grievances there, and I think it's a pretty real moment.
Why can't she understand it? So, I mean that she's very intelligent, she understands the economy, and so why in that moment, and I assume this is in response to Sanders doing well,
right?
Kind of from your take on her, why can't she grasp what's going on? And you can read about it in any newspaper about what's going on. Why can't she get that?
It's anathema to her. This is somebody who grew up believing that you could affect big change through the system. She's somebody who got in trouble in 2008 when she argued with Barack Obama, whether it was Martin Luther King or Lyndon Johnson, who was responsible for all the civil rights legislation of the mid to late 60s. because she believed that you had to be inside the government mm-hmm. to make big change. And so I think looking at the public having this mood of not let's elect new people to change the government, but let's elect people to break down the existing system, which, let's be honest, that's what Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are promising to do, whether or not they would actually be able to accomplish that. That was their promise. I think for her, it was hard to understand and hard to look at the system and say to herself, well, people aren't going to move left or right. They're actually going to go to another place entirely where they want to break this stuff down. They're going to understand eventually that they want to have something that is somewhat cohesive with what they've seen before, somewhat continuous with what they've seen before, and that they can get, sort of lesser change and be happy with it. And obviously, that's not where the public was.
And so one of the characters in your book is Robbie Mook, who probably most people have no idea who that is. But now they do because of your book. Who is he and what role did he play in the campaign?
Well, he's the campaign manager. You learn in the pages of the book that he's very frugal. He always feels like the campaign's running out of money. There are complaints voiced.
How old is he about?
He's in his 30s. He's worked in Democratic politics coming out of college, a Vermont native, I believe.
Yep.
And he's always, his whole idea is to scale back and to not give the states everything they need. and that's a complaint voiced by some on the ground who feel like they're going into war without armor. And we detail some of that in the book. But he's always scrambling. He always feels like the campaign is running out of money. And he is very evidence-based and wants evidence. She wants evidence, Hillary Clinton. And so she and he are always relying on data analytics to kind of get them through the campaign. And I think that's why a lot of there has been a lot of finger pointing at this guy.
What does that mean, data analytics? It comes up in the book a lot.
Yeah, so he was very, very married to the idea of finding efficiencies because he believed the campaign was running on a shoestring. Though they raised $1 billion, they create this big apparatus. And he's always looking for efficiencies. And he relies on and believes very much in finding efficiencies through the use of data, particularly data about voters. And in some cases, you're talking about analyzing the electorate through demographic information, race, ethnicity, age, magazine subscriptions. And the idea is that you're able to figure out where that you can get the most bang for the buck in terms of trying to turn people out versus persuading them, the most bang for the buck in terms of where you put your surrogates. Where does Bill Clinton go out to campaign? How many people is he going to get out to the polls by going to X place versus Y place? Same thing with television advertising. Which congressional districts do you target during the primaries with your ads? Can you run something on Waco television and get better bang for your buck than on Houston, Texas television? So all these determinations are being made by looking at data and sort of slicing and dicing what they're seeing, and to the exclusion at times of sort of the art of politics. In particular, Robbie decided at some point that it was a fool's errand to try to persuade people that didn't agree with Hillary Clinton to come out and vote for her, that it was so much more efficient to simply find people who agreed with her that were not planning on voting and turn them out to the polls than to do the sort of two-step of finding somebody who disagreed with her, persuading them to agree with her, and then getting them out to the polls. And of course, that makes sense. That it's cheaper to do the one than the other. But I think that, I know that President Clinton thought it was crazy that she wasn't going out and talking to people that didn't agree with her in a presidential campaign.
And this comes from the Obama campaign in 2008. Mm-hmm. This is their effort to kind of replicate what worked.
She overlearned in this way. Mm-hmm. And I think that was one of our big conclusions, that she tried to fight the last battle and she tried to emulate President Obama's campaign in 08 in particular and then in 12. But it always kind of came up short because it is a new election cycle and she should have been doing everything and not just throwing all her eggs into one basket.
Also, Barack Obama is your candidate,
yes,
your data analytics look good. Uh-huh. It is easier to persuade somebody when Barack Obama is your candidate than when Hillary Clinton is your candidate. And the defenders of Robbie Mook would and do say it was difficult to persuade people to vote for Hillary Clinton who didn't agree with her, that, you send somebody out into the Michigan suburbs to go knock on doors, and maybe you'll find some people that change their mind, but by and large, people have already made up their mind about her, and that was very difficult to do.
And how did he get into the campaign? Can you tell people? How did he become such, he's a young guy, how's he become such a power broker?
We ask that question a lot, but he worked for Terry McAuliffe, and we think that Terry McAuliffe was his way in, that he's obviously very, the governor of Virginia, very close to the Clintons. He had just won his gubernatorial election for him, ran his campaign, and so I think he put in a good word for him.
And David Plouffe, the former Obama campaign manager, was also a big Robbie Mook supporter and fan and patron. So Hillary Clinton had looked at the Obama folks. She'd even gotten a sort of a pre-plan from Plouffe about how to run the campaign. And he was also somebody who was influential on Mook's behalf and was a sounding board for Mook during the campaign.
And then Jake Sullivan, who's that?
It's her director of policy, really smart guy. Secretary Clinton loves him, thinks, she said, that he'd be president one day. Mm-hmm. She thinks he's this brilliant mind. And he takes on more than just policy, we find out in this book. He becomes kind of a chief strategist of sorts, and he is quietly elevated while other people are demoted.
Mm-hmm. And then so you have that team, and then the book has, I can't remember what you call them now, the old Clintonites, or the the other part of the team, kind of the more traditional people who wanted her to go out and try to, who's in that orbit?
So that's, Bill Clinton's there, John Podesta's sort of in that group, Craig Smith, who was Bill Clinton's first political director and sort of a Florida specialist, is in that group, Mignon Moore, Mignon Moore, who was on the plane with her after February, talking about how, Hillary Clinton talking to her about how she didn't understand the electorate. Mignon Moore is then brought into the campaign. At the time, you've got this clashing going on between John Podesta, the campaign chairman, and Mook, the campaign manager. And rather than empowering one of them, what Clinton does is creates like a board of directors mm-hmm. of six people called the Super Six. And Mignon Moore has like no title. She's basically, in fact, on her door at the campaign, it said Super Volunteer. She's got no title on the campaign. But she and Jake Sullivan, who gets elevated to be chief strategist de facto, nobody ever reported this, by the way, during the campaign.
Yeah.
He gets elevated to be chief strategist. He's on the Super Six, Podesta, Mook, Jen Palmieri, who's the communications director, and Huma Abedin, who is Hillary Clinton's sort of closest personal aide. They make all the decisions for the campaign together as like a sort of like a board of directors. Less streamlined, and in some ways, some people argued that it actually worked better than the two guys just clashing with each other. But certainly not a sort of quick, easy hierarchy to get through.
And so then they have this challenge. A lot of the book is about the primary, mm-hmm. Which was interesting. I mean, it's really about a page 100 on. You move, with about 100 pages left, you move into the fall campaign. So it's the primary against Sanders, which is a defining part of the story. And you talk a lot about the strategy that they use to defeat Sanders, which in the long term will undercut their ability to beat Donald Trump. Right. Can you talk about how that worked?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I think a lot of people ask us all the time, well, how did Bernie Sanders really, how did he play into her loss? And I think he did. And you kind of see this in retrospect, especially because around, particularly at the end of the primary, he is really hammering home the fact that, she is not so much crooked Hillary, but that she is working alongside with the big banks and is speaking to them. And he kind of implants this idea of, can you trust Hillary Clinton? And Donald Trump later picks up on that and runs with it. But I think that's why we spend so much time on the Bernie Sanders angle and how she also doesn't see him coming, and he becomes almost like a Barack Obama. She barely wins in Iowa, or she barely wins, and then she loses badly in New Hampshire. And Nevada becomes such a key state, and she has to battle really hard there, or else the narrative could have changed dramatically. So I think that's why we do, but maybe you can speak to the...
Yeah, I mean, I think also just sort of interestingly, she learned from Barack Obama in 2008 how the Democratic primary elections mm-hmm. work and how you accumulate delegates. And one of the things that's true about that process is that you accumulate more delegates by running up the score in big cities, which generally means that if you're the candidate who is winning big blocks of minority voters, you will come out with a disproportionate number of the delegates from mm-hmm. each congressional district, each state, and be in a better position to win the primary. her base, more than anything in the Democratic primary in 2016, was black women. And they ran up big scores for her in a lot of states that mattered for her in terms of building a pad in the delegates. So you think about the southern states, South Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, places like that. In addition to that, African-American men were going strongly for her. And Latinos, both men and women, going strongly for her. In order to beat Bernie Sanders, she focused on these groups and at times, again, you know, away from working class whites. Mm-hmm. The argument is that the more attention she paid to that base during the primary, the more she alienated working class whites. And then when she gets to the general election, again, we talk about Mook and his data. It's easier to turn people out who agree with you than to persuade people who don't. So you focus more and more on that base, less and less on the working class whites who were her base in 2008. And ultimately, it becomes impossible to persuade people who might have been persuadable at the beginning of the process.
Is there anyone in the campaign during the primaries, of all the different people you've mentioned and others, who sees this, who says, we have a problem, this is not going to work?
Yeah, well, I think they saw it in different places. They certainly understood it in New Hampshire when they lost by 22 points there in a state where she had won in 2008. They understood that it was happening, but I don't think they understood what to do about it. And they were also worried about losing the primary. So the primary concern in the primary was to win. And the easiest route to do that was to win disproportionate numbers of delegates. And the easiest route to do that was to focus on people of color. Mm-hmm. And they did that because that was the first priority. However, they also realized they weren't doing, to varying degrees, realized that they weren't doing what they needed to do with working class whites. I think Mook was so in love with numbers that he saw it as, we're just going to win this primary and we're going to hit our numbers. And it doesn't matter what those numbers look like, and the art doesn't matter so much. And he would even talk about it this way. I mean, when he was writing memos, it would all be about, we're going to win the nomination because we have, you know, we're going to get this number of delegates out of this state and this number of delegates out of that state. Whereas most campaigns would talk about that they're going to win the nomination because they have the best platform or the candidate has the best message. I really think that they got distracted even from what they could see as being a potential problem. And of course, Bill Clinton thought it was a problem for most of the campaign that they were not. His wife was not speaking to working class whites, a group arguably that he understands as well as anybody in the country.
And then you have a great section on the convention, which for most people seemed, if you were watching on TV, pretty calm, scripted, and contained. It certainly didn't have the energy and anger of the Republican convention, but you have a different portrait of what's going on behind the scenes.
Well, so it begins with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and people think that after that Monday that the cloud has been lifted, she's been sent off. But, you know, all along they're worried about the Bernie Sanders folks in the crowd. And so there's a text message system set up so they can kind of mask what's being said on the floor of the convention hall and in the arena. And then there is, you know, at one point they pass out American flags and you hear people chant USA, USA. And that's really to drown out the Bernie Sanders folks. So there were all these tactics in place to kind of make it seem like it was great and that the party was unified. But behind the scenes, it was a bit of a mess.
And Sanders, does he go along with the calm or is he more an instigator?
Sanders' top people worked with the Clinton campaign. So when Amy talks about a text messaging system, it was actually the Clinton high command and the Sanders high command working together to sort of stifle the Bernie dissent. Mm-hmm. Because the Bernie team had decided at this point that they were going to try to help Hillary Clinton win the presidency. That was the writ to them. Mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders even sent out a text message to his delegates saying, please don't cause problems. He was no longer able to control them, which is also a sign of the degree to which some of the pro-Bernie people were actually just anti-Hillary people who had become Bernie people. But, you know, this was a situation where the two campaigns were trying to come together. I don't think Bernie Sanders ever got to the point where he loved Hillary Clinton. And I think his delegates felt that, you know, sort of felt the same way, but they split. Some of them were, you know, willing to be helpful to her. Others were trying to cause problems. We have this thing at the end of the chapter there where, you know, Mook tells friends about this woman coming up to him at the end of the convention and saying, oh, those American flags were so beautiful, the big flags waving. And he's, you know, he's like, yeah, they were thinking to himself, like, yeah, those were great. They were covering up all the crazy stuff behind all the placards and, you know, people chanting stuff.
And does she, like, by this, so now we're in the summer, about to go in the fall, does she understand her own vulnerabilities, or is she not aware of them? Meaning from the difficulty still of articulating a vision to this difficulty you guys have talked about with white working class voters, does she know this, or...
In a sense, yeah. And there's some misogyny kind of mixed in, and
right.
she is addressing that at some point. There's one time where she is addressing a crowd of veterans, and she feels like they're not with her, and they're not responding to her message. So she kind of tweaks it and goes off script a little bit, which is rare for her, and talks about the fact, this idea of being a female commander-in-chief and what that would be like, and how even it's uncomfortable for her.
Mm-hmm.
That passage, I think, was really interesting. I think because she, on the plane ride after that, she's talking to her speechwriter, who asks her about it, and she says, "Yeah, the crowd wasn't really feeling me. I figured this is a good time to try that out." So you can see where her vulnerabilities were and what she tried to fix and what she felt needed fixing.
Mm-hmm.
That was one big one. But I think, yeah, and it's interesting because into the summer, she kind of disappears for a while and goes off on this fundraising junket. And that's also because Robbie Mook felt like the campaign was once again running out of money. So
yeah.
You see all these things kind of flare up again in the storyline, which I think makes it interesting.
Isn't anyone telling him not to save money? I mean, you have amazing stuff in the last part where they're not polling in these states to save money. Aren't there people in the campaign saying, you can't do this? We need to know what's going on.
Yeah, particularly at the lower levels.
Yeah.
You know, people in the states are begging for help, but they're just not getting it. And they're not really in a position to countermand him. And look, she chose to stick with him.
Yeah.
The one thing, you know, even when she started to elevate other people to sort of join him in the ranks of the Super Six, she never took away the data or the budget. She believed, and you know, or at least according to people we talked to, that she had messed up in 2008, and that there were newer, younger people who were, you know, understood the newfangled data and stuff, and that she should follow the advice of those people because they had some special magic thing that was going to help her win the election. And I mean, I joke a little bit, but you can understand that there's like a vulnerability in that, right? That there's a lack of confidence in her own instincts, perhaps, that she's gotten to the point where she got burned in 2008. And so now she's putting her fate in the hands of this like 30-something guy and this data that he's got. And it turns out, you know, those numbers weren't right. And by the way, she was getting advice and getting pleas from other people to change directions. And so she chose and chose. Well, it's possible that either way would have been wrong, but certainly this way was.
And the whole allure in 2008 of the Obama campaign, if I remember, in part was David Axelrod, really stressing not to get shaken and not to follow media stories that are saying the electorate's turning one way and to stick to those numbers and to be cool. So I imagine kind of part of that lesson, which Obama would continue to use, were still in her head as all these challenges from Sanders and then confronting Trump unfold.
Right.
I want to leave a little time at the end for some questions we're getting, but I still have more questions before we get there. Basket of deplorables. Where did that come from? How did that get into a speech?
Sure doesn't match up very well with Stronger Together. I think it's the way that she conceived of the Trump electorate, and it's not just that moment. I mean, she had gone out and done a speech about that I think was pretty well received about, at least among Democrats, about Breitbart
mm-hmm.
and about white supremacists. And she had gone in that direction. And instead of targeting Donald Trump or even his advisor, Steve Bannon, or even a news institution or whatever, you know, however you would classify Breitbart, instead of going after those things, she goes after the voters individually. And it's really kind of inexplicable. But I think the thing that's even maybe harder to get out of isn't just deplorables, but she said they were irredeemable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's something that, you know, I think for a lot of religious voters, the idea of irredeemability is foreign, right?
So this came from her, though. It was not some written text from what you found.
She believed that. I mean, yeah. That was her way of talking about.
And the fallout is clear pretty quickly.
Well, so they, behind the scenes, they have a conference call the next day. It happens on a Friday into Saturday. Her senior advisors feel like it's taken care of. They've responded to it. She's kind of backed away from it a little bit. But then that same weekend, she falls. And so that news cycle kind of goes right into the next news cycle. And the bigger, larger question of that wasn't just Hillary's health, but what else is she hiding? And what else is going to happen here? So that, unfortunately, went right into falling and that the health episode and all the questions that people felt needed to be answered. And I think that was unfortunate for her, too.
And then the debates happen, and then the Comey announcement happens in late October. What effect did that have on the campaign? Did they understand right away what this was going to mean?
She always, when an aide told her about it on the plane, she said, "Well, I knew this was something was going to happen." And I'm paraphrasing, but she expected something, but I don't think she expected it to be this. Yeah. And when you hear her talk about it now, she feels like this was the reason why, this was what derailed her campaign and her ambitions to be president. And I think that was it's something that she's holding on to.
There's a certain myopia in that, though, which is that Jim Comey doesn't exist, but for two in our public consciousness, but for right. two important things. She set up an email server that had classified information on it that the FBI would have to investigate once they found out about it. And Loretta Lynch and Bill Clinton, the attorney general and the former president, met on a tarmac just days before right. the adjudication of whether or not they were going to try to prosecute her. But for those things, Jim Comey is not a factor in this election. And to say, well, Jim Comey came in October 28th and threw the election one way is to ignore the rest of all of the events that led to that. But in addition to that, we talked to Republicans October 26th, 2 days before the Comey letter, who were telling us about how their numbers were moving up in some of these key battleground states in the Midwest. And certainly the Clinton people could see their numbers tracking down. They track it to the Comey letter, but it's hard to disaggregate what caused what. You know, I mean, they did say that the Clinton people we talked to said that they were seeing Republicans come home a lot faster at the end mm-hmm. than Democrats, undecideds who were Republican-leaning or Democratic-leaning.
So some of the changes that will happen and become pronounced in late October or early November already underway before this happens. That's another way to at least think about some of this.
Right, and you don't hear the Clinton people talk at all about the Obamacare premium increase letters that went out across the country. I mean, to think that that didn't have an effect at all is unlikely.
So let me ask a question someone wrote in from Facebook. Will the Democratic Party change as a result of Hillary Clinton's campaign, which Obama changed the campaign for this year? Do you think this is going to have an impact for 2020?
I think it has to, and that's why you're seeing Bernie Sanders still play a huge role in the party. Elizabeth Warren is coming up. You're hearing this cry for new blood. And I think that's something that will have to, come out a little more. And you're seeing a whole new crop of people emerge. Some people are talking about Kamala Harris and Amy Klobuchar and some other folk, Cory Booker maybe. But I think one thing.
Some of the people who are in the VP.
Yeah.
Running.
Some Joe Biden, too. And so I think you're going to see a lot of new names emerge. And I think a lot of people felt like she wasn't the right person for this year. When people are craving an outsider, you don't bring in someone with the last name Clinton. She comes with her own baggage. And I think there's this cry for new, fresh blood.
I'd be stunned if you didn't see the party rules change significantly.
How so?
I think that they will do things to encourage more candidates to run, to change the debates so that there are more debates earlier. I think it's possible you would see, if not in this cycle, within the next two cycles, a change to the format of delegates and superdelegates.
And that, I want to go back, though. Now I have another question. The debates, you talk about preparing for these debates and how they prepped her and how she prepped herself. Can you tell us a little bit? We all saw it from TV, and it was kind of a surreal experience to watch. But what was going on behind the scenes as she approached these different events?
So she basically brings on her longtime advisor, Philippe Reines, who comes in and plays Donald Trump. And he goes to the detail to
That's
get everything
right. That's a political person?
He right. is her longtime spokesman and senior advisor for communications, has worked with her since her Senate days, knows her really well, and isn't afraid of her. And mm-hmm. that was key. They wanted someone who could really play Donald Trump, but not only that, just be fearless in going after her and bringing up Bill Clinton and his past and everything else. And so, you know, a lot of people felt like this guy, Philippe, made sense. And so he comes in and he goes out and gets a suit, a red tie, cufflinks, everything. He even at one point puts self-tanner on his face to see if he should look like Donald Trump. And he realizes that makes him look too much like a Halloween character, so he backs off that a bit. But he even goes to great lengths to secure his debate file so he doesn't lose it. So he actually goes and gets bondage stuff to attach it to himself so he doesn't leave it in a cab somewhere. But basically they did everything they could to prepare her and prepare her well. And at one point in debate practice, he's getting under her skin and she is visibly agitated and she's rocking back and forth. And he keeps pressing an issue and she is saying, God, you're so annoying. You're so annoying. And that's basic. And Philippe feels like he succeeded because he doesn't know if she's talking about Donald Trump or him.
Uh-huh.
So they took it very seriously. And she is a student and comes in really well prepared on issues. So she was well prepared to talk about the issues in great detail.
I mean, the one thing that I think they discovered, though, in doing this was that Donald Trump had a lot easier way of communicating sometimes. I think that her aides, particularly Reines, realized as he was going through this that Donald Trump's offhanded remarks and quick barbs and things like that actually penetrated pretty well. And it was difficult for Clinton, as she was going through sort of long answers with nuanced policy, it could be difficult for her to get her message across as easily. And so they thought that it was going to be a real problem. I think all of them, to a person, would say she won all of the debates.
Mm-hmm.
I think most analysts would say that. I would say that. We say it in the book, that by any traditional standards, she won the debates. But Trump's ability to communicate with his base was pretty good. And there were moments in those debates where he was winning.
And how much is the skill versus how much was sexism in the electorate, in the media, in politics? I mean, she couldn't shatter the final part of her goal.
I think he was a better salesman, and it comes down to what James Carville calls the big idea. He got his big idea out. It was he wanted to make America great again. And at the end of the day, when you ask people what he stood for, I think they knew. You know, he got across the message that he wanted to build a wall. People knew where he stood on trade. She was kind of all over the place. Even though diehard Hillary supporters could tell you why they're supporting her, there wasn't any clear message for why she should be president.
He used, whatever its roots, he used America first. And the flip side of that is, what does she put first?
Mm-hmm.
If not America, and I don't think the answer is Russia, but the answer might be herself or any other number of things that voters might plug in there, to your point about sort of simple messages.
Did you hear a lot about, now that you mentioned Russia, did you hear a lot about that in the final months of the campaign? The investigation, the rumors?
It was out there, but she brought it up in the debates.
Right.
But then, at the end of one debate, they chose to focus on Alicia Machado instead of focusing on Russia. I think that was, when in retrospect, I think a lot of people will go back to that and wonder why. But I think there's a bit of revisionist history going on right now when, they're kind of beating the drum on Russia and saying it was out there. I mean, there were some missed opportunities there for sure.
She wasn't able to effectively make the case, even though the intelligence community had concluded that Russia was trying to help Donald Trump in the election.
Uh-huh.
She was not able to make the case that voters shouldn't vote for him because of that. And I think it's arguable that that is a makeable case.
Mm-hmm. So you guys are really pushing back on a lot of the arguments that have come out about why she lost. I mean, your account, and from what I hear, is really about the mistakes that this campaign made with a key part of the electorate, as well as her own limits as a candidate. I mean, am I?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, in a word, yes. I mean, I don't think of it as pushing back, because I think that That's not the point. I mean, the point isn't who's right or who's wrong. I think it may be for the Clinton folks who's right or who's wrong. But I think the question is more, what happened? Why was this person who was, you know, fated to be president of the United States, in her view and that of many other people, who was ahead in the polls the entire time, why on election night, as we detail in the book, does she go through this, you know, incredible shock, this shattering loss? And you know, the answer is, more than anything else, flaws in the candidate herself.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the call with Obama that you guys write about?
Two calls.
On election night. Yeah.
So the White House had decided at one point, sort of late in the night, that the election was over. And the Clinton people had not made that decision yet. They were still arguing amongst themselves as to whether they wanted to wait till the morning to see if some of the results would flip or, you know, there might be automatic recounts triggered. David Simas, the political director at the White House, calls Robbie Mook, the campaign manager, and says, the president doesn't want you to drag this out. And Mook is like, I know where my candidate is, and she's not ready to fold yet. So he says, look, she's not going to go out and give a concession speech. And that was sort of the fig leaf of, you know, if she's not ready to go out and give a concession speech, she's not going to concede yet. It's not really about waiting to see if the election results are going to change. You know, she didn't want to say that. They get off the phone. Nothing's resolved. Obama calls Clinton, and he says basically the same thing. He says you need to concede. And his argument is basically that Donald Trump has been calling into question the legitimacy of the election for weeks and weeks, and the Democratic response has been, you're going to have to accept the results of this election, and they, for the good of the country, like, you can't just drag this out and have a question about who won the election, especially when it's clear he won. So Obama's not entirely convinced that Clinton has gotten that message. He calls John Podesta, his former aide in the White House, who is now her campaign chairman. And Podesta has just gone out publicly at the Javits Center, where her victory party is supposed to be, and told everybody, we're going to wait till the morning to say something. Obama gets Podesta on the phone. He says, look, don't drag this out. For the good of the country, we've got to have a conclusion to this, you know, sort of now. And around this time, Hillary's deciding for herself that it's time to call Trump. So I assume the Obama call had some influence, even if Obama wasn't entirely sure it had gotten across. She cuts off the debate among her staff, says, all right, give me the phone, I'm going to call him. Huma Abedin, her top aide, calls Kellyanne Conway, Donald Trump's campaign manager, puts the two of them on the phone together, and Hillary says those two words that she thought she would never say, congratulations, Donald. Mm. And they talk for about a minute, and Trump tells her, you know, she ran a tough campaign or whatever. There may even be tapes of this. And then, you know, Clinton sits down at her dining room table to work on her concession speech, which she had not yet looked at. Earlier in the night, she'd looked at the victory draft and worked on that, but not the concession draft. That just gives you an idea of how confident she was going to win. So she sits down to work on this with her staff and Chelsea Clinton. And Huma Abedin walks up with the phone again, and she says, it's the president. And Hillary Clinton just sort of recoils. She physically, she winces. She doesn't want to take this call. This is the president of the United States calling the losing candidate. It's a consolation call. And she, in this moment, sort of, it hits her. Like, she's let down herself. She's let down her party. She thinks she's let down the country. And President Obama, who she always thought had not gotten enough credit, she feels like she's let him down. This is his legacy that's at stake. So she finally takes the phone reluctantly from Huma Abedin and puts it to her ear and says, Mr. President, I'm sorry.
Well, we're going to end on that note because we are out of time. And that's a very poignant story that I think captures how she felt, how many Democrats felt, and the shock that many voters certainly felt when the campaign came to an end. So thanks again to Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes for joining Politics and Polls. The book, again, is Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doom Campaign. It's out with Crown. You can get it on Amazon, bookstores, other online places, everywhere. It's everywhere. It's a bestseller. So congratulations to you guys. It's a really great read. And thanks, everyone, for joining us. And we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.